Hello and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube, you can like and comment on our YouTube videos, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can support us on Anchor. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. So this week we are doing a Samuel L. Jackson retrospective. So Samuel Leroy Jackson is an American actor, producer, and honorary Oscar winner. One of the most widely recognized actors of his generation. The films in which he has appeared have collectively grossed over $27 billion worldwide, making him the second highest grossing actor of all time. This week, we're taking a look back at some of his iconic roles and his impact on the industry. So I have a couple of movies, couple of Sam favorites of my own, and I think Dale has a couple of his, so we're just going to go through them. Dale, why don't you start us off? What was your first Samuel L. Jackson film?
First, that's tough, because it's not really first in chronological order, but I think it's the first movie I probably remember him or seeing him in. That was probably Eddie Murphy's Raw. Like, in the beginning, he's playing Eddie Murphy's like uncle in that movie. And also, I remember seeing him as well in Coming to America, as the homeless guy who's trying to rob McDowell. So that was like my first recollection of actually recognizing like who he was. But for me, I think my most common or gateway, depending on who you're asking, would probably be Die Hard with a Vengeance. Saw it when I wasn't supposed to, thanks to my cousins. It on like I think VHS. But I do think for me, honestly, it's probably my actual recognition of him was probably Star Wars, the prequel trilogy. And I think that probably is for a lot of younger people of a certain age, their major exposure to who he is.
Yeah. I never saw the prequels, so I don't know.
Oh, wow.
What happened there. But I do know he's in them and that he kept his lightsaber. So yeah. I know that little fact. I can't remember exactly the first movie. I think the first movie that was like I recognizably understood like it was Samuel L. Jackson was Coach Carter. Like yeah. That was the movie that was like my childhood. I watched that so many times. Yeah, that movie had like a huge impact on me. I don't know why, but there was something about him being the coach of that basketball team that just gave me hope. I don't know. And I saw him in a movie called The Negotiator.
Yeah.
Where he's trying to deal with like a hostage situation. I saw that. And I think there was one other movie that I saw of him early on. I think I saw parts of Jungle Fever. I was way too young to be watching that, if that's the case. But I feel like I saw that, like a little pieces of that film. So, yeah, I think for like most people who grew up, like who are, you know, African-Americans, you probably had a lot more access to him way before Star Wars or the Avengers movies. So, like, you've known of him for a really long time. But talk us through some of the movies that kind of had the most impact on you that stars him. One thing that I really like that he says is that he always watches his movies, which I think is really funny because, you know, all the actors try to be like, no, I'm too sensitive to watch my movies. And he was like, no, I will watch all of my movies.
I guess the most one for me would probably, I think, Mr. Glass and Unbreakable. That whole movie as well. And M. Night Shyamalan, the whole evolution of like the hero and the villain, that kind of dichotomy. But for me, in all his movies, whether it was in his early part of his career or further down when he was started getting prominence but still taking bit roles, it seemed to me like even if he was doing a bit role, Sam Jackson is always like, look, you gonna know who the hell I am. Like, he's over-act, he's always like full of energy. And he always mentioned, like you said, a while ago, that he loves watching his own stuff. I feel like he, more than anything, he reminds me of, there are some basketball players or athletes who play, and they'll say, look, I'm getting paid to play a kid's game. I'm going to have fun. I'm not going to take it seriously. He reminds me of that type of person as an actor. Like, he'll take on any role, and whether it's serious, like Nick Fury or, you know, Star Wars, he can play to serious. Like, he's done stuff on Broadway. He's played Martin Luther King on Broadway and stuff like that. Or if it's a joke role where he's playing a druggie or whatever, he'll ham it up. Like, he'll take any role and knock it out the park.
Yeah, that's very true. I think he's always like, he's a scene stealer. Like, whenever he shows up in something, he always like commands the attention of the viewers, which is a great talent. And I like that him and Denzel Washington and I think Wesley Snipes, like, they all came up at the same time. So you can see their influences on each other. Like, Denzel will always do like the serious action stuff. Wesley Snipes used to do all the action stuff. I don't know what he's doing now. Is he still acting? Who knows? Wesley, but
I think he stopped acting for a while due to his, you know, after he came out from jail, due to his accountant falsifying stuff and stealing money from him. But he's doing like smaller, like, I think, streaming platform stuff now. But still that same like early mid '90s, 2000s, Sam Jackson, Denzel, Wesley Snipes were the three main black guys in Hollywood.
Yes, that's very true. Just those three. No, not just them. But like they were like the most prominent ones.
Yeah.
So I know a movie that for me was like maybe my favorite performance he's ever given. Oh, it's kind of hard. It's two. So Django Unchained, I'll talk about it a little bit later. Because to play that role is really like I don't know how, like, where you have to go mentally to get into the mental space to be able to play like an Uncle Tom and like do that every single day. Like, that's, to me, that would be extremely difficult. But his performance in A Time to Kill, it was probably my favorite one. I watched that at school. We're talking about the movies that we've seen at school, and maybe we shouldn't be watching them. I don't know. The fact that your teacher played enough at your school still makes me laugh. Like, I cannot believe that actually happened. Okay. But but A Time to Kill, I watched that at school, and it was so good. Like, because the premise of it is basically like this man's daughter gets raped and like attacked by these white men, and they're in the deep South, so it's like, are these men actually gonna get charged? No, like, so they have to have this entire court case that like the entire community is invested in. Matthew McConaughey, I think, is the lawyer for Samuel L. Jackson's family. So that combo there was really good. I just really enjoyed his performance in that because it is incredibly heartbreaking, but he still has to be like the pillar of strength. And I think there's a moment in there where he's like, you know, I'm the father, I'm supposed to protect my daughter, and this still happened to her. Like, it was just one of his best performances. I thought that was an incredible performance. Like, and to me, like, now that, I don't know, Sam Jackson now is like, he does a lot of the action movies and he does this stuff on Broadway. He was just on Broadway doing The Piano Lesson. But a lot of his stuff is like action flicks, like, you know, what you kind of are accustomed to seeing him play. But I like kind of more back in the day, he was taking a lot more risks of doing really interesting roles that were like character focused. He did Pulp Fiction, obviously, and I like this performance too because it was just a lot more vulnerable than I think we've probably seen him in a lot of films. But yeah, that was one of my favorites.
Yeah, he's up to a point now in his career and even earlier that playing vulnerable characters was not his forte or wheelhouse. And I think that's something that happens as you get older and you mature as a person. You kind of gravitate to roles or experiences that reflect you a bit more. Because even though people, like you said before, have issues with his role playing the Uncle Tom and Django Unchained, he is honestly very socially conscious, you know, on a lot of stuff. Like, people don't remember, no, like, he went to Morehouse in Atlanta, Bachelor's of Arts, and at one point, I think he got kicked out. They gave him back the Bachelor's of Arts, you know, honorary degree after he became Sam Jackson, you know. But if I remember the story correctly, he was kicked out because him and a bunch of other people were protesting, like, either the president's or dean's office. So issues like that were always at the forefront of who he was as a person. And but it's just more now that he's also taking on roles that also embody those characters and beliefs.
Yeah, I think his, I don't know, his relationship with Quentin Tarantino in terms of, like, director and actor has been somewhat controversial, I guess. I think it's been controversial. I think that's okay to say. But,
I mean, the only controversial one is that role in Django Unchained. That's the thing. Like, Jackie Brown is not an issue. Pulp Fiction is not an issue. It's just that one role where people are concerned about, and it makes sense because I think the prior one to that with Quentin was the Kill Bill stuff, and it had a lot of real Asian influences, and people were kind of perturbed with Uma Thurman playing an Asian-esque character, but that's a sidebar. So, yeah.
Did you have issues with his role in it?
Django Unchained? Yes, I did. Because there are sometimes when you're watching properties, you kind of you lose a bit of respect in a way in the midst of it. Like, yo, how could he sit there and be, you know, play this Uncle Tom? And then you kind of also have the issues of, you know, yes, I understand it's a period piece in a way, but you have Christoph playing the N-word and stuff like that, Leo playing the N-word. And my concern was it was Quentin Tarantino giving the carte blanche for these white men to use that language, you know? So, but yeah, at the end of the day, I got over it because there actually are, till this day, black men, black people in general, who still act and behave in the manner that his character portrayed.
Yeah. When I watched it, I didn't see an issue with it. And it wasn't until the whole discourse after it, where Samuel L. Jackson was literally like, Quentin Tarantino can't be racist, that I was like, oh, is there a problem? Because, okay, to me, when I watched it, I was like, well, this is what they're depicting. They're depicting the South in, like, the 1800s.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, these people existed. Now, my question was, like, as a Black person, it is kind of, it's a lot to put yourself into that position where you are doing those things.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, just, like, as an actor, like, how do you get into that mental space where you can, like, play, like, a bootlicker to, like, Leonardo DiCaprio's slave owner. Like, it's really, I was just wondering about that. But I do understand how, like, I guess looking back on it, people can have issues with it because a white man is directing it.
Yeah.
Like, if a Black person directed it, I don't think it would have been that big of an issue, but I think it's because Quentin Tarantino did it, and I can understand that because, like, he does take a lot from other cultures constantly. So it's like, it makes sense that, like, people would have some issues with him in particular doing something like this. But I don't know, Django Unchained is still one of my favorite movies. I just watched it the other day and I was like, yep, so great. So I don't know. it's all of the people in it other than, like, Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, and Kerry Washington are terrible. Like, they're all terrible people, like all the rest of them. So I wasn't expecting much from them. I will say they did a great job. I think everyone in that film deserved an Oscar because they were all fantastic. Like, every single person absolutely brought their A game to that. So that's just my little, that's my perspective on that.
I don't, like, and I don't know, like, I know you said before that he has, like, the record for highest grossing actor. I don't like, it's kind of a weird caveat because, like I said, he'll take any role if the script is kind of good or if he gets a chance to ham it up, which I have no issues with. But also, like, being the highest, second highest of all time, what goes into that? Because, like I said, all of them are cameos or bit roles. Are you just taking into consideration, like, all his projects, you know? And also, that lead role thing is kind of skewed now because the top 10 is, like, all people from Marvel movies now. So,
yeah.
And he's had, and, like, I think, like, even to the point, if I look at the list right now, Chris Pratt, who's only done, like, 26 movies, is a fifth. Sam Jackson is a fifth behind Scarlett Johansson and Robert Downey Jr. But Sam Jackson's done like 64 films. So that's the thing. Like, how do you, like, that highest grossing actor is kind of, you know, iffy to me, you know? So
you're asking how they calculate it?
No, I know how they calculate it, but I don't think, like, are they, like, how they assign the roles, like, actually no, that I made the statistic for lead roles, like, he's been like 64 lead roles but he's in third, but overall he's been in like 140 films, and the person who has number one for all roles is Stan Lee with just 50, and that's just cameo appearances with all the Marvel properties. So I'm like, that's a weird measurement to say I'm the highest grossing actor, but I'm not the highest grossing lead actor. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. Maybe I'm grasping straws, probably. I don't know.
Well, I guess if your movie is making buttloads of money, you are seeing some of that. So
true.
And he's been in like a billion Marvel movies. So like, I get it. I get how he ended up there, even though he'd just be kind of coming in and out.
Yeah.
He played like a really major role in Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
And that made a buttload of money too. So look, I see it. I see it for him. Like, speaking of Avengers, I think Sam is such a pivotal moment in what the Avengers or what Marvel Cinematic Universe would become, because it's his cameo at the end of, I guess, with the first Iron Man that really like sets up the entire scope of like what they were going to do for the next, I don't know, 20, whatever, how many years has it been? Forever. It's been so long. And he's still going.
Yeah.
But every single time that he shows up in it, I'm interested. Like when he showed up in Spider-Man, I was like, great. I love that you're here. Like, and he, even though he wasn't really there, but like he was there. when he was in, what is it, Captain America Civil War, I think he showed up there too. Every time he just popped up, I was like, I'm interested in this. Not that I wasn't before, but I like when he pops up and stuff, because I think he's really made the character of Nick Fury so, I don't know, interesting. Like, you learn more about his past in Captain Marvel, but before that, you don't really know anything about him. And I like that there was like a little mystery there, but it was like enough to kind of hook you, because you're investing in Sam Jackson, not totally Nick Fury at first, unless you are a comic book fan and like know a lot about that character. But for like the general viewer, Sam is the hook into the character, and you know, the bald head and the eye patch, like it's iconic. Like he really made that, he really was iconic in this role, like, and he's still going. And the fact that Secret Invasion is coming out in a few weeks, where we get to explore more of his life. I'm so fascinated because I'm like, I have been investing in this character for so many years now that like I'm actually ready to see like who he is and what's going on there. Very intrigued.
Yeah, it's funny because his involvement with the Ultimate, like the movies, is because I think for a time period, you know, you see like Miles Morales and certain characters, they were in Marvel's Ultimates line, which was kind of like a rebranding while the older comics were still going on to attract younger readers with more update stories. Like in old comic books, you know, Iron Man is World War II, you know, a hero from World War II, that's Arms Dealer. But a lot of those elements from the Ultimates line have been pulled into the cinematic universe. And they just were like, hey, we're going to make Nick Fury look like Sam Jackson. and they're like, whatever. And then now it become full circle. Now the Nick Fury you know is not the old white guy with the patch and everything from the comics. The Nick Fury you know from, you know, if you read the Ultimates line and now you're watching this version, the movies now, is Sam Jackson, like, completely. And they also brought his version into the regular Marvel's world, kind of being the white Nick Fury son. Doesn't look like Sam Jackson, though, but, you know, they still brought him in. But I am, like, it's kind of weird watching him in the beginning of, you know, his bit cameos, because in a way, his Nick Fury portrayal, unless it's like Captain Marvel or the stuff we're seeing in Secret Invasion, where he's actually, like, running and gunning, it seems like more of a spy movie, and it's interesting to see a 74-year-old man playing a super spy kind of role. But for a lot of it, to me, though, and I don't know, maybe that's the way it comes off in a way, seems like very Magical Negro in a way. Like, Nick Fury just pops up magically in a location. Like, I remember, Age of Ultron, he pops up at, you know, Hawkeye's house, and he tells the Avengers exactly what they need to hear to get their shit together, and their excuse is, oh, he's Nick Fury, he's the world's greatest spy, he knows everything. You know, like, that kind of thing. So, but...
Is that not in line with his character?
It is in line with his character, but I find it funny. He's playing a black man, just pops out of nowhere, espouses wisdom, and then disappears. And we don't see him for the rest of the movie. That's why I'm saying it gives me kind of Magical Negro vibes, in a way. But it's still... I'm still enjoying his portrayal, because the fact that he does know how to play those serious and dramatic roles experienced in Broadway. So when he gives those bits of dialogue, it actually draws you in. Or when he sings something stupid like, they're tired of these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane. Or, you know, in Black Snake Moan. I remember in Black Snake Moan, there's a scene where he's not saying anything. He's just staring at the camera with a serious face. But because of how disheveled he looks, you break out laughing. Like, those are the kind of things I know Sam Jackson for. His ability to ham it up and his ability to get super serious. And there are very few actors who know how to pull both those extremes off very well.
Yeah, I feel like he keeps it exciting and fresh with the roles he picks.
Yeah.
I forgot about Snakes on a Plane. Yeah. That was... It's still one of the most, like, quotable movies ever. Like, that movie was insane. And I loved it. Like, I loved every minute of that insane movie. So good.
So, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
When you're thinking Sam Jackson, which director do you identify him with?
Probably Quentin. Because I feel like he's done a couple of movies with him.
I mean,
at this point, or Spike.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I remember a lot of his early roles. You know, School Days, Do the Right Thing, Mobetta Blues, Jungle Fever. You know, that kind of thing. He did a lot of his more early roles, which is why I think a lot more black people at the time before Star Wars, and then Star Wars turned into Coach Carter kind of thing. I think that's why a lot of more black people knew him in those roles. Because like I said before, like, I saw him in movies that I should have seen as a kid, because black people were going to watch, you know, Do the Right Thing and stuff like that before, you know, white America. I think he did, if I remember correctly, Pulp Fiction was in 94, you know. But by then, Do the Right Thing was 1989. So from that point on, black people knew who he was because he was the radio DJ and Do the Right Thing. And then, you know, Pulp Fiction comes up and it pushed him into prominence more so than Star Wars to the wider white audience and stuff like that. I remember you said earlier that for a while, like, black people have known him for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's his early collaborations with Spike Lee were largely the reason for that.
Yeah, and I think it's just typical of us always just being, we're always put on before everyone else gets put on. But I also love that, like, Sam and Denzel, like, how they are kind of nurturing, like, this new crop of young black actors. John David Washington, obviously, I guess because, like, Denzel and Sam are so close, like, Sam watched John David grow up, essentially, so, like... But now he's this great actor doing all these amazing things, like him, Michael B. Jordan. I'm sure Will Smith to a certain degree, too. Like, I'm sure he had both of those guys as huge inspirations and maybe even mentors as he was coming up too. Yeah. So I like that they have been so kind of hands-on with like this new generation of young actors who are coming up and like giving them opportunities, talking to them, letting them shine. I think that's really great. And still acting, like these guys are old and they are still going and they're doing action films. Like that is what is the craziest thing to me. Like, not you like running around with guns and doing like fight choreo in your, what is he, 70 or something?
Like 74.
Denzel is in Gladiator right now. Like, what is going on? I hope I'm that active when I'm that old, because if I'm not, I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
I want to keep going. That's incredible.
It is. You know, he's got, you know, the funny stuff. Was that kid's book, the audiobook, Go to Fucking Sleep? Oh, Go to Sleep. Yeah, so.
Yeah. He really is like an icon. Even like him having a potty mouth is what people know him for. And they like ask him to do it. Like they ask him to like curse them out in the streets, which is funny to me. But yeah.
I mean, you know, in public, you know, I think everybody knows that one person who curses like really well and imaginative. And Sam Jackson is that person for Hollywood. You want somebody to explode in like a funny, cool, comedic way, he's one you call, you know.
Very true. Yeah, so let us know what your favorite Sam Jackson role has been. Mindful isn't A Time to Kill. That's probably my favorite, but yeah. Great actor. Kind of wish he won an Oscar on his own.
Yeah.
And not like it was an honorary Oscar, but hey, you have an Academy Award, so I guess that's fine.
and that's the thing. I think he's only been nominated for an Oscar once, and that was in Pulp Fiction '95, and that was it. He never nominated again, you know, until till then. Same thing with the BAFTAs, only has one BAFTA for Pulp Fiction. He won Berlin for Jackie Brown, won Cannes for Jungle Fever. It's been nominated for Golden Globe like 3 times, has not won at all, but you know, it is. But he's up for a Tony Award because right now he's doing Broadway with The Piano Lesson. So we'll see how it goes. And I think Broadway was like his first theater was his first love and first foray into acting. So, which is weird because you don't see a lot of that with younger actors anymore, particularly younger Black actors, where Broadway, they pivot from Broadway to live action. Most of a lot of the Black Broadway people kind of stay in Broadway unless you're lucky, like the Hamilton cast, you know, who've now been able to pivot into film stuff. So
yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, that is interesting. I feel like theater back in the day, probably when like Sam and Denzel were coming up, was like the place where they could actually, you know, be creatively stimulated, really show off their skills. Versus now, where I think television and film has been the entry point for a lot of young Black actors. I will say a lot of young white actors are still starting in theater, but not so much the young Black actors. Like, I think Michael B. Jordan's first role was like on The Wire or something.
Was
it?
Funny enough, no. His first role was taking over Chadwick Boseman's role on General Hospital. Like, they both played the same person in General Hospital. And Michael B. Jordan has mentioned before when he first met Chadwick during Black Panther, that was the first thing they bonded over. Because Chadwick wanted more, like I said before, talk about Chadwick in his career. He wanted more representation of Black people and stuff like that. And they told him, all right, you want to do more, and they fired him. And then they brought in Michael B. Jordan, who then from there went to The Wire. But yeah.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I like that story.
Yeah,
that's really cool. Okay, last thoughts? Wrapping it up.
A long, illustrious career, like, whether it's Broadway, on theater, you know, whether it's acting, like, every single imaginable role possible, or even in animated stuff, whether it's anime or, you know, cartoons or even video games, like Sam Jackson, no matter what the property is, or even audiobooks, as we've seen with Go to Fucking Sleep, he is a grabber. Like, he fully grabs her attention. And to me, honestly, I think one of his best roles in a way was probably, maybe because of my age, was probably him playing Officer Tenpenny in Grand Theft Auto. Like, he played a cop you hate perfectly to the T, and it fit his demeanor and personality so good. And it's funny that, to me, that's his best role. It is a voice acting role in a game where you don't really play as him. But hey.
Okay.
Moving on from that to the box office. Not much has changed for the most part, over the past weekend. I know we spoke, if you were online, you saw our YouTube content. We did talk about put a little clip out dealing with the issues that the Mermaid has had or is currently having. We delve into a bit more later on in this episode. But of course, you know, of course, the top 10, the number one movie across borders, of course, Spider-Man Across the Universe. You know, it beat out The Little Mermaid as the number one movie, and number three is of The Boogeyman from Disney. It is they're also their first week as well. And currently sitting at number four, down from number three, with Guardians of the Galaxy, and dropping from two to five. These are top five. Would be Fast X. So, yeah.
Are you going to watch that movie or no?
No.
I'm just wondering.
No.
No? Okay.
No. I am Toretto family out. I tapped out. Yeah.
Hilarious. Okay. Moving on to the news. The Directors Guild of America has reached a tentative agreement with the AMPTP that will avert a strike of its own. If the directors had gone on strike, it would have urged the studios to come to an agreement with the striking writers more quickly. So, like we mentioned a couple ex like we mentioned a couple episodes ago, the Writers Guild, the Directors Guild, and SAG-AFTRA were all going to be conducting strikes around the same time, which was going to be kind of insane if like the directors and the actors would have would have gone on strike along with the writers. But the directors have reached a deal. They still have to be it still has to be presented to the DGA's national board, but they do get a lot more benefits, including just the ban of live ammunition on set. I know that was a huge thing when the Rust shooting happened, so that's not going to be a thing anymore. And also paternal leave benefits, which I don't know why that wasn't a thing before, but okay. So John Avnet, who is the chair of the DGA's negotiating committee, said that we have concluded a truly historic deal. Basically, people were thinking that, like, okay, if this deal kind of comes or goes the way that the directors want it to go, SAG-AFTRA and the WGA would be more inclined to, you know, I don't know, meet or have the negotiations kind of pan out better so they wouldn't strike or SAG-AFTRA wouldn't strike and writers would come off of their strike and they would end it. But they are not doing any of that. Like this deal with the directors doesn't mean a lot to either of them,
No.
according to what I am seeing. Yeah, their SAG-AFTRA is still like, no, we're still negotiating. We haven't reached any conclusion. And the Writers Guild are like, no, our issues still aren't resolved. So whether this went well or not, like that has nothing to do with our concern. So like the producers are gonna have to figure something out because this strike is going on, what? It's been a full month now. So if SAG-AFTRA doesn't reach an agreement, the producers are actually gonna have to make a lot of moves to end these strikes, because even if your Directors Guild is fine, you still need actors and you still need writers. So,
yeah,
I think falls in their court.
The Writers Guild also spoke out with their concerns over their contract agreement that the producers made with the Directors Guild, and they really said a lot of what they allowed the directors to get in such a short, and let's be honest, the directors really did not strike at all. They were basically just negotiating for a new deal. And they were like, all these things in their like collective bargaining agreement were all the same things the writers wanted. Like, the directors are getting like a 67% increase in international residuals for their work. And then, of course, you mentioned maternal leave, you know, better, they get better terms and conditions. And the biggest caveat they got was an acknowledgement that AI is not a person and regenerative AI cannot replace actual directors. And that was honestly the two big things, residual issues with residual and the issues with AI. And they got that for nothing. But that also goes to the point of a lot of these. I know when we're talking about directors, a lot of people here kind of focus on your Spielbergs and your guys like that, who also are, like, all the big name directors are also producers as well. So it's kind of funny how well they were able to negotiate that. But I'm happy for it because all the ADs get it, all the unit and production assistants, even the stage managers get that. But, and like I said before, I think they were able to get this stuff done so much easier is because a lot of these big name directors who are in the skill to post the producers. End of story. So, and it's unfair that, and the two things that the writers want, better residuals, and you can't, AI is not a person. And all three of these people, all three of these groups are mainly fighting against the AI not being a person. Like, the actors are not concerned over their image and likeness being used in movies and stuff that without their, either without permission from their families or used without their compensation. So, and then you have people thinking AI can write everything in the world when it honestly can't. So it looks like it's going to come down to the next, the writers and the actors to get to settle this issue a lot more than the directors. I don't think residuals are a bigger concern. Well, they kind of are, because we've heard actors like Cindy Sweeney from Euphoria talking about, yes, she's an actor on a major show, but she's not getting like major show money. So there are some actors who have name prominence who are not getting paid on projects that their name prominence should afford them. So all three of them are fighting for the same thing. So we'll see how it goes and continues.
Yep.
Moving on from that. Oh, the movie of the year. This is like the cinematic draw everybody has been waiting for. The controversial HBO show, starring, of course, The Weeknd and Lily Rose Depp, debuted, and it did not go with, you know, the most amazing fanfare. Of course, you know, The Weeknd's been on a roll for like the last couple months, like, trying to clarify, massage, and also complain about, you know, the press's concerns with his portrayal and in the project. The show is supposed to tackle those issues of, you know, the Nepo baby stuff, which Sam Levinson kind of knows, you know, addiction and the scummy, overall scumminess of the showbiz business, but it did not come off as it should. There were scenes there where photographers like commanding her, you know, very Britney Spears like, if you're familiar with Britney Spears in her career, like Give Me Innocence, Mischievous, and Sex, and the movie kind of just derails, becomes a hodgepodge of a lot of, I don't know how to describe it. Mostly they make, I think predominantly the issue with the project was they made Lily Rose Depp character largely really just there and one dimensional, and she does very little, which is sad because the story is technically supposed to be about her. So.
Yeah. I didn't even know that this came out until today.
Yeah.
I was not aware that this premiered today or yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm getting from the responses of the show is like it's what we would expect of what the show kind of promoted itself to be. And it's funny because like there was all this controversy going on around it and people were like, well, the show's not even out yet, including myself. I was like, well, I guess we won't know until it shows. But when it dropped at Cannes, people did have an opportunity to actually watch it. And their responses were like, it's not good. So it came out yesterday. It got pretty good viewership. I think people were just like interested to see like, okay, what is the show that everyone's been talking about? Like, what is it actually going to be like? And it's been reviewed as like, it's not good because it's basically like a snuff film or something. And The Weeknd is a terrible actor. Like that's basically like the keynotes from the initial episode. And it seems like the problem really is that like Sam or the writers of the show, the developers of the show, really weren't interested in actually making a show about, you know, a pop star who gets in over her head with a sleazy guy because she wants to be famous. It seems more like we just wanted to, you know, depict our fantasies through Lily Rose Depp's character and then have The Weeknd there for like vibes. Like that's kind of what this show seemed like initially. And it seems like that's very much confirmed. That is what the show is. Like, it's not anything other than just these men looking at Lily Rose Depp with her tits out. And it's just like cinema. So, yeah, I wasn't expecting this to be anything other than that. But now that people have watched it and have reviewed it and are saying, yes, that is what the show is. And like all the problems that we thought were going to happen from what the information we got from the Rolling Stone article and all that, like that's in here. Because I think one of the things that they were trying to do, the actors were trying to say, was like, yeah, it's controversial, but that's what we want. We want it to be provocative. We know that it's going to cause upset. As if like the provocative nature of it was what was going to keep people from watching it. And it's like, no, like that's not the issue. The issue is like, are you going to develop these characters or are they just going to be there to look cute? Like, that's the problem. So, yeah, I'm interested to see, like, what this is going to do. Like, if people continue to watch it, if viewership is going to go up, I don't know. Because it just seemed like it kind of arrived and everyone was just like, oh, okay. Yeah. But apparently viewership, like, high numbers. It didn't do as well as, like, Euphoria or something, but...
I'm interested to see. I'm probably gonna watch it later on. I'm interested to see. I mean, I want to watch for myself and see how the story progresses or it evolves, because I think this is kind of the opposite. Oh, now like Euphoria has evolved more into a bit of style over substance. It wasn't really that way before the beginning. Like, you have, of course, talk about Maddie's evolution of a character. You have, you know, Zendaya's character, her dealing with drug issues. We've had every other smaller character, like, have their own stories and how they evolve as a person, which, like, you want to see them evolve and grow. And then now it's kind of been a bit more stylistic in a way. But the substance is still there. You know, it's the substance is still fighting a good battle with the style. Whereas this, I feel like, was more... more style first than substance. So I want to see if it does course correct to kind of give a bit more of an even balance in the way that Euphoria kind of has. Even though there's still some too much style in Euphoria, I do believe it's not done to the level that currently is in, that's currently reported in this project. So, yeah.
Yeah.
moving on from that, you know, I mentioned earlier in the box office stuff about Little Mermaid currently sitting at 2, and we did mention if you saw our Facebook or YouTube shorts, talking about how the general reaction as far as it not making the numbers it was supposed to make opening weekend. Usually for a movie like this, you kind of do want at least your opening weekend or your opening week make back your budget. I think this movie took about, I want to say, $280 million to make. And I think it only drew, not counting this weekend, but around up to Friday, Saturday, it only had made $260. But it's kind of been released in international markets. I know we were talking about ourselves as there's a big dialogue globally on having Black people portray these kind of roles. So it's currently only made about $3.6 million in the first 10 days of China. That's the worst showing ever among Disney's live action adaptations. And in South Korea, since June 4th, it's only made $4.4 million. So it's not doing well. But Disney says it knew they would face challenges internationally, but they're kind of surprised over the backlash and its impact. I'm going to read out this paragraph. This paragraph is from a Chinese newspaper called The Golden Times, and it ran an editorial on Disney's motives. It goes on to say, the controversy surrounding Disney's forced inclusion of minorities in classist films is not about racism, but it's lazy and irresponsible storytelling strategy. Many Chinese netizens said that like Snow White, the image of the mermaid princess in Han Christian Andersen's fairy tale has long been rooted in their hearts, and it takes a leap of imagination to accept the new cast. To me, that is, I don't know how to put into words how to hear another I'm not gonna say minority, because globally Asians and Black people, we are not the minority, but just because you're so beholden to this image of a fictional person that you refuse to see it any other way. It's kind of really close-minded.
I'm dumb.
There's so many other words I could say about that, but don't want to get in trouble. So I'm, you know, keep it to myself. But yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like when it comes to fictional characters, like you did, like it really shouldn't matter who is inhabiting the role. And also, like, I just feel like that speaks to a bigger issue. The fact that that Disney put out a statement thing that they were surprised is like so, it's so corporate of them, isn't it? Like, oh, we couldn't believe it. Like, who could have thought racism? It's like, what are y'all talking about? Like, are you kidding me? It's so, like, were you watching when she was announced as Ariel? Like, that whole backlash just over her casting, and you're going to sit here and be like, we were surprised. No, you weren't. Like, it's just ridiculous. And also, like, I mean, I think that those markets are so important. Obviously, people care a lot about them, especially when you're making such a big budget movie like this. But then it also just speaks to whatever social issues are going on in their countries where they can't go see The Little Mermaid because The Little Mermaid is Black now. Yeah. It's just like, if you thought racism was confined to America, you're wrong.
It's an ongoing thing, particularly with Disney faces with Black characters entering the Asian market. If you remember the international poster for Black Panther with Chadwick Boseman, had him without his helmet, without his mask on, with his claws in his hands, everywhere else. But in China was the only market that had him masked, you know, and then you talk about issues, you know, John Boyega has spoken out this before, issues with Star Wars. Star Wars posters, for the most part, especially the first two, he's kind of featured prominently, a bigger character, a big Chinese market. He's, like, reduced to a smaller corner, and, like, the TIE fighters and stuff and all the spaceships take more prominence in the poster's composition. So it's been racial issues as far as black characters being released in Disney projects have been a long issue for the last, like, 15 years-ish. So, yeah, it's... And Disney wants that international box office money, because if you don't market to China, you're not going to get the money in returns we've seen with all these other Avengers movies, where a large portion also of their box office went just domestic, but it was also international. And you kind of, in Hollywood's on this kick now of we want the Asian market. So, yeah.
All right, let's talk about what we watched this week, Dale.
I, of course, like everybody, this weekend who had a chance to, I did watch Spider-Man Across the Universe. I hope I'm saying it correctly. Across the Spider-Verse. Yeah, amazing movie. They spent a little bit more time on one of the secondary characters, you know, Gwen Stacy. I love the use of colors in her scenes when the story focuses from her perspective. How they kind of, you know, we see Miles has a definitive art style, very more comic book inspired. But when they switch to Gwen Stacy, it becomes more watercolor, not enough details. And it also is reflective of her as a person. And also when she's feeling certain emotions, the whole color palette changes. And it's very beautiful, very well done. I love seeing the progression of Miles as a character. He's clear in this movie. He'll have that inkling of, you know, wanting to be a better hero, or those concerns of, am I living up to people's expectations, not just of being Spider-Man, but of also being a young Afro-Latino man, you know, living in New York, you know. And I think that's a story everybody can relate to, whether you're Afro-Latino, but if you're from a immigrant background, a minority background living in the States, you're kind of under a lot of family pressure to exceed and go and above and beyond. So I felt like his story, you know, especially looking back at adolescence and being pulled in most directions, I thought it was really relatable. And I love the growth his character had. The ending was kind of already spoiled to me in a way.
Because, don't spoil it. I haven't seen it.
Well, not ending.
No
ending.
Spoilers.
Not ending. Ending. It's not really ending.
No spoilers.
They had already tweeted out that, hey, we're making a sequel. So going into the movie, I was like, oh, they're making a sequel. So, okay. But the ending didn't end the way I was expecting it to end. But viewing it now, I go, okay, it makes sense why they said there's going to be a sequel and they announced it ahead of time. But yeah, it's still a beautiful movie.
Yeah, I was away this weekend, so I didn't get a chance to see it. I'm going to go see it this weekend. Can't wait. Okay, so I watched a movie from the 50s called Funny Face, starring Audrey Hepburn and Fred Astaire. I knew about this film because obviously I love Audrey Hepburn, but also, like, it's such a fashion movie. Like, there's so many iconic stills of, like, Audrey in these amazing gowns that I knew already, like, just from, like, my Pinterest board. But, like, it was cool to see the movie. It's a musical, which I'm not usually into. The music was okay. Like, it wasn't great. It's not like one of the top tier musicals that you could really enjoy. It was fun. But I loved the character who plays the fashion editor, who's like an Anna Wintour, Meryl Streep, Devil Wears Prada type of, not even a villain, but like an anti-hero type of situation. I enjoyed her enormously. She kind of stole the show a little bit. Like, the vocals, the attitude, like, she was giving in every scene. So, Yeah, basically the story is about like a bookshop keeper who gets to be a model and goes to Paris. Like, it's very kind of in the vein of Devil Wears Prada, except like she does no work. She just goes to Paris and is a model because she is beautiful and it's Audrey Hepburn. Like, that's the premise of this film. And it's the relationship between Audrey and Fred Astaire is weird because Fred Astaire is old and Audrey was very young. He like originated the role on Broadway in like the 20s, so like he was very old by the time that like this came around. He still did a great job, but there were very uncomfortable moments. But then it's like, okay, I guess it's the 50s, so you have to like excuse it, whatever. It was fine. Audrey Hepburn was great, and
as always,
yeah, that's as always absolutely lovely in everything that she's done. So yeah, that's the film I watched. And then I watched, believe it or not, Fleabag. Fleabag that came out in 2016. I finally got around to actually watching it. Starring Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who also wrote it. And the early episodes, I was like, this character is insufferable. I can't stand her. She's so annoying. The character basically breaks the fourth wall in the show. And at first I was like, I don't like this. I'm so over it. And then as the story unravels, because basically like as the audience member, you don't know information about this character. Like the information slowly is revealed as the episodes go on. And then by like the end, you're like, oh, that's what was going on. That's why she is so crazy and like self-destructive and a mess. And I was like, okay, that's really good. The second series, amazing, like actually great. I loved that. It was so good. Olivia Colman is in it. She plays a horrible person, but she's so good. Like, she's so good. And all the actors in it are so good as well. Like, everyone plays their parts to perfection. The writing is really good and funny. So I understand the hype now. Like, when this was coming out and everyone was, like, all over it, I was like, what is it? Like, a London version of Girls? Like, that's kind of what I thought it was going to be. But it's not like that. It's actually really well done. Not saying that Girls wasn't. I'm just saying, like, I understand the hype of why this was a thing and, like, why Phoebe Waller-Bridge was a thing. Or is a thing. But, yeah, it's really good. It's 6 episodes each season, and it's, like, 20-something minutes each episode. So you can really just, like, binge the whole thing really quickly, which I liked. I liked that, like, things moved quickly in this. But yeah, it's a really interesting character study of like grief and family and using sex as self-harm, which is really interesting, but it's funny. So you're not like, you don't feel depressed at the end of it. You just feel a bit sad for her. The hot priest thing that everyone kept talking about, I finally get what that is now because I watched the show. So yeah. Would recommend. Very good.
Sorry, I was caught between a cough, a yawn, and a laugh. All
I don't know what happened. I was like, what's happening over there? Do you have a stroke?
hey, don't put that on me, Ricky Bobby. But so you've never so. I find it interesting that so much content was kind of pulled out of this. Well, it does kind of make sense because it originally was like a one woman show.
Yeah, it was fun.
And I think there was, they said, like, I think the first season draws more from the show, and then the show then diverges further on. So I'm saying what I'm hearing, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess a lot of it, yeah, because it was a play first, and then she made it into a show. And then the second season happens years later. I think it happens in 2019, so that's a good few years from the first season. So I think she had time to like rework the material and like do a second season. And then I think it went back on Broadway, and maybe now it's becoming a movie. I don't know. I'm hearing different things, but yeah, very interesting. And I get it. Like, you know when like shows have hype and you're like, okay, well, is it really that good as everyone's making it seem? And then you watch it and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, well, I get why. It's usually comparable. Like, the hype usually is to be believed in most cases. Not all of them, but most cases.
But that was a big gap between, you know, the first season and second season, like a three-year gap between the two. That's something you usually only see in like films, you know. But for a show to take that larger gap is like, wow, knowing the fact that it's only, what, 6 episodes a season, is what you said. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good, though. All right. Well, that wraps it up for us here today. Thank you all for listening. We hope that you take care of yourselves and you're having a great week. Make sure to check out all of our social media. Support us if you can. And we will see you guys in the next episode. Goodbye.
Au revoir.